I'd like to call the Senate State Affairs Committee meeting to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:30 p.m. on Tuesday, March 18th. We are currently in the Belts Committee Room in Juneau, Alaska. Present today are Vice Chair Senator Bjorkman, Senator Willikowski, Senator Yunt, myself, Chair Kawasaki. We do expect Senator Gray to be here shortly. We do have a quorum to conduct business. We would like to thank also Carrie Tupoa from Senate Records and Naomi Boyles, the moderator with the Legislative Information Office. On today's agenda, we have a fourth hearing on Senate Bill 64. Senate Bill 64 is the elections omnibus bill that we've been working on. And just to review a couple of amendments, we will have invited testimony and then some public testimony. We also have a first hearing on Senate Bill 35, Delivery Network Companies, by Senator Bjorkman. We have a first hearing on Senate Bill 34, repealing the 90-day session limit, by Senator Giesel. And first hearing on Senate Bill 37, Strategic Plans for State Agencies, by Senator Kaufman. First, we're going to hear about a couple potential amendments and some comments we wanted to bring before the committee on Senate Bill 64. We have Carol Beecher, the director from the Division of Elections. We also have, just Director Beecher from the Division of Elections. And we've had a handful of amendments that we had brought forward at a prior meeting from Senator Yunt. And I think we wanted to have a couple questions just laid out on the record on that and some other amendments that we had potentially been talking about. So if we could get Director Beecher. And for the record.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Carol Beecher, Director of the Alaska Division of Elections.
Thank you, Director Beecher. We had a handful of questions regarding the voter information portal. It was material we just received, and I think all the members have this now. No, they don't have it now. We have it. Okay. Okay, well, why don't we just go through maybe some of the bill questions that we had from the other day had to do, I don't know, Senator Yunt, do you want to ask those questions on these two amendments?
Yes, specifically if we could just touch on ballot tracking and things that go along with that, whether we'd be able to do that or not, just so that the public can hear. So,
through the chair, Senator Yunt, currently the division has a portal. It's called My Voter Portal, or MVP. And individuals can sign up on that. We currently are not able to give them the code, or that is to say they can't get the code by themselves. They must contact the division for the code, and then they can go into that portal. They can see when a ballot has been mailed to them, and they can see when the division has received the ballot. That's pretty much as far as tracking the extent of it, because the division doesn't have a cure process, so it doesn't contact the voter about any deficiency with the ballot until after the election.
Do you have a follow-up?
Is there ways that, so there's been discussion of ballot tracking and doing it in a more, I guess you could say, extensive level. Is there hiccups that you see with that, or potential issues that could come of that?
Through the chair, Senator Yunt, we are currently contacting some of the different vendors out there that do ballot tracking, such as what they use in Anchorage, Ballot Tracks. There's several other entities. I believe Ballot Scout is one. And so we're reaching out to them to get a presentation to see what they are able to do and the extent that it could be used in Alaska.
Thank you.
Yes. Senator Willikowski.
Can you just explain some of the complexities that exist in ballot tracking? In Anchorage, you have an urban area with post offices, and in rural Alaska, you don't have this infrastructure. And I guess absent putting an RFID chip in everyone's ballot, how can we genuinely track ballots out to different parts of Alaska? What are the challenges that exist?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, your point is exactly the challenges that we are aware of, that a lot of the post offices that are in the rural areas are contract and may not have the equipment to scan anything. The way that the post office is set up in Alaska, the hub that reads the postal codes is located in Anchorage. And from the information that we've reached out to look at some of the bigger entities on whether or not they can track ballots coming back is a real challenge with how that tracking mechanism gets put onto the envelopes, the ballot envelopes. So for our rural areas, we do not at this juncture believe that a ballot tracking system would work for the rural areas.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Director. And I know we're looking at Section 41 of the bill. This is the H version of the bill dealing specifically, it calls it ballot tracking system. It's an item that has followed several different permutations of this piece of legislation. Section 41 basically says that the director shall establish an online system, procure a system from a third party, and the system should do a couple different things. And it says the system should allow a voter to confirm the ballot's been sent to the division. That might be pretty easy. Track the date of the ballot's delivery to the voter. That one's going to be, I don't know how you would track that. Again, like Senator Wilikowski pointed out, confirm the division's receipt. That one part might be easy. So clearly we need to look at this section 41. We want to try to adhere to some of the best practices, including these ballot tracking. But I think some of these are going to be very difficult, and I hope that Senator Schauer is listening too. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, just on section 41, are you able to – and I support ballot tracking. I just want to be clear on that. The challenge has been how do we do it? And are you able to do, if we were to pass Section 41 as it's written, would the administration be able to do what the law requires?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, our planned meeting with these vendors will answer a lot of those questions for us. We, in the past, would say no, but we are hearing that there may be better technology now. So I don't have a good answer for you on whether or not we could comply with every component of that section, but we'll know more after we meet.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wilikowski. Are there any additional questions regarding any of the elements in the bill? I know ballot drop boxes was something I think was being considered. We had in the version of the bill, Section 43 of the bill deals with ballot drop boxes. They became popular, especially during the COVID time, where they had these locked ballot boxes, especially in the Anchorage area. But I know we had one in Fairbanks that was located right outside of the building at the Division of Elections. They didn't have that this year, but they still had a box that you could drop it off inside the building, so you had to go walk inside. Section 43 of the bill, I think we did have questions about whether the director could adopt regulations for drop boxes that might be provided outside of the division's regional offices, and maybe if you've got any comments on that, on any of the safety or security that might come along, might be a problem with that.
Chair Kawasaki, as you know, the division doesn't currently have drop boxes, and the boxes that were used in 2020 were borrowed from the municipality. So there would be a requirement to purchase boxes, determine where they would be stored on the off-election years. They're not small. And the moving of them to the locations. We're thinking that we would probably need cameras for some kind of monitoring, and clearly they would have to be closed. Well, they may want to be closed at night to prevent malicious activities with the boxes. and for monitoring them on election day. I believe this section says that on they have to be closed at 8 p.m. so that no one is allowed to vote after that time. So we would have to have them all manned to make sure that the boxes were closed at that time. With the if the legislation passes that requires that the division provides the postage paid return envelopes for the ballots, the need for ballot boxes may be mitigated by individuals being able to simply use the United States Post Office to drop their ballot off in their post offices all over the city. And perhaps these ballot boxes wouldn't be needed in that case.
Yep. Senator Wilikowski.
And I think you're right. I think postage paid does mitigate the need for the drop boxes. I'm just wondering, would it be a large cost to put a ballot box inside the Division of Elections so that somebody could just come in on election day or 10 days before the election and just drop off their ballot inside? Try to keep the costs low. I think drop boxes are something we're certainly used to in Anchorage. People like them. They use them all the time. And I'm just wondering if having something inside where you wouldn't incur as much of the costs is something that would be more doable.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, if I can ask, are you referring to an actual box such as the municipality has, or simply a metal drop box that could be at the counter?
Probably just something at the counter.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I believe we have something like that. Anyone can go to an election office on election day and drop off their ballot.
Senator Wilikowski, follow up.
It seems like we're getting really expensive if we're talking about 24-hour security and cameras and people monitoring them on the day of the election and storage. It just seems like it's getting really expensive. So, and I don't know what the fiscal note. Do you have a sense of what the fiscal note might be?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, we know the cost of the boxes. If we purchase them, we have not figured out the freight and or the cameras, the monitoring system that would be required.
Great. Any further questions on Senate Bill 64, the Elections Omnibus Bill, before we move to public testimony? All right. Thank you, Director Beecher. We appreciate your time, appreciate clarification on a couple issues. We will go ahead and open up public testimony. Public testimony will be limited to 2 minutes. If you can make it under that two-minute mark, that would be great. And we will keep public testimony open until... We'll keep it open. So if anybody has any questions or comments they'd like to make on any version of the bill, we're currently on the H version of the bill. Folks can send that in also to senatestateaffairs@akleg.gov, senatestateaffairs@akleg.gov. First, we'll go on to Mary David. Mary David is located in Nome. If you could state your name and your affiliation for the record, welcome to the Senate State Affairs Committee.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for providing this opportunity. For the record, my name is Mary David. I live in Nome, Alaska, and I serve as the Executive Vice President at Quirk.
Great, thank you.
And so here are my comments. Quirk is also a member of the Alaska Regional Coalition. Collectively, we represent about 109 communities and 70,000 people. We support election reform and avenues to make it easier for voters to return their ballots. So I have heard from other members of the Alaska Regional Coalition the challenges they experienced this last election, with election offices being closed or open for only a short time, and the challenges with recruitment of election staff, and even rejected ballots due to not having witness signatures. So in my district, which is House District 39, in 2024, the general election, we only had a 40.9% turnout for voting. It is important to make elections accessible to all and to address barriers to voting, such as witness signatures on absentee mail-in ballots, which disproportionately affect rural Alaska and military voters. In many rural communities, English is a second language, so ensuring that language translation is available, and even having backup personnel of staff in case somebody doesn't show up, I think that will also help with increasing voting. I just want to say thank you for addressing this important legislation this year and providing the opportunity to provide public comment.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. David. Are there any questions? Okay. Hearing and seeing none, we will go on next to Mr. Ed Martin. Ed, if you are there, if you could state your name and your affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Chair. Kawasaki, and my representative is there, Jesse. I'd like to address this bill 64. First off, I'm not in support of it for numerous reasons. I did get, and I want to thank the director for answering my public records requests. I think what this bill really should have in it, it should address the contractor who's carrying our ballots around. And that's what they are, contractors. Under the laws that deal with contractors, we're all supposed to be bonded to the state. This company is not bonded. They're carrying around our franchise rights to vote in this country in national elections and in state elections, and they are not bonded. In fact, at the bottom of the page of the license, it says they have to follow all other state laws and federal laws. So I hope that she will correct this immediately before the next election. As far as signatures on ballots, particularly those that involve those absentee ballots, I believe that we shouldn't change that whatsoever. There has to be a witness, as far as I'm concerned. When you go into the election buildings for on election day and your staff there, that they definitely will have a witness, not that you voted in private, but that you were there, besides any ID. And we definitely need a valid ID. A picture ID would be the best. Thirdly, chain of custody. Chain of custody is not a chain of custody when ballots are dropped off at the election office in Juneau into a mail room and nobody signs for it. I thank you for my testimony, and I hope you correct this stuff in the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Martin. Thanks for calling in today. We are next moving along to Marge Stone King in Anchorage. Welcome to the State Affairs Committee.
Thank you, Chairman Kolakowski and members of the committee. I'm Marge Stone King, AARP Alaska Advocacy Director. AARP represents the interests of Alaskans 50 and up. 50-plus voters consistently vote at higher rates than any other age group, which means they decide elections. So voter and candidate engagement is important to us. AARP has a proud decades-long history of nonpartisan voter engagement. And in that voter engagement work in the last couple election cycles, we heard frustrations and complaints about absentee ballot requirements for witness signature by seniors who live alone, and rejection of absentee ballots without rejection with a valid reason, but the inability to fix that error and notification coming after the election. So AARP supports election laws that maximize the opportunity for voter participation, and for those reasons, we fully support the provisions in SB 64 that expand voter access, including removing the witness signature requirement on absentee by mail ballots, creating a ballot curing process for voters to have recourse to fix the errors in their absentee by mail ballots, whether it's the signatures don't match, they forget to sign, they're missing an identifier, et cetera. Allowing voters to register to vote absentee early or question within 30 days of election day, and providing return postage paid on absentee by mail ballots and or requiring at least one secure drop box for every 20,000 residents. I apologize, I missed the filing of the CS, and so I have not reviewed the CS, but it appears to have made a number of changes, so we'll review the bill again and hopefully be able to submit a letter of support for the bill in full. But at this time, we support those provisions that expand that voter access. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stone King. Thank you very much for your testimony today. Are there any other folks in the room who'd like to testify on Senate Bill 64 today? And anybody online? Okay, hearing and seeing none, we'll go ahead and close testimony for now. Testimony will remain open, though, and you can send any email to the Senate State Affairs Committee directly at senatestateaffairs@akleg.gov, senatestateaffairs@akleg.gov. Bringing Senate Bill 64 before us, are there any questions for either Director Beecher or any questions on the bill itself or any of the elements? Okay, well, we have the H version before us. What we're going to do is we're going to set Senate Bill 64 aside. We're going to announce that we'd like another amendment deadline by Wednesday. This is the last time. If you can get any comments or any suggestions on how to finesse some of this wording to us by Wednesday afternoon, and we will try and work with you as much as we can. We'd like to present a new CS, pass the H version on Thursday. So with that, we're going to go ahead and set Senate Bill 64 aside, and next we will go ahead and bring up Senate Bill number 35. Delivery Network Companies. It is sponsored by Senator Bjorkman. Senator Jesse Bjorkman is here, and his staff, Savea Bieber, are here to present the bill. Welcome to the Senate State Affairs Committee. And I think we do also have some invited testimony that's all off-net.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, esteemed members of the Senate State Affairs Committee. For the record, my name is Jesse Bjorkman, and I represent the northern and central portions of the Kenai Peninsula. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 35 today. Senate Bill 35 amends statutes related to workers' compensation, aligning individuals who provide delivery services through delivery network companies with individuals who provide services through transportation network companies. The legislation will define these workers as independent contractors, provided that they meet statutory requirements. Currently, delivery network companies are not defined in statute, which has led to confusion and litigation across the country, threatening these services that consumers value and depend on. People have built an affinity, you might say, for digital network companies for food and other items. These delivery network companies can deliver prescriptions, groceries, household supplies, and even pick up prescriptions from a customer's home and get them filled at a pharmacy. Drivers will often swap between passenger transportation and goods delivery, and sometimes are even logged onto multiple apps at once, depending on the demand of customers. Roughly 90% of drivers work less than 10 hours per week. These drivers usually provide delivery services to supplement their income so that they can work their full-time job or go to school during the day, or for other reasons. The vast majority of DoorDashers or delivery service providers prefer to remain working as independent contractors, thus creating a need for a path forward that requires drivers to have the ability to work as much or as little as they want, and whenever they want. If the chair wishes, Senator Kawasaki, my staff, Savea Bieber, is here to go through a section of the bill.
Yep, that'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki and members of the committee. My name is Savea Bieber. I'm staff to Senator Bjorkman. Section 1 of the bill amends AS 2330-230A by adding delivery network company couriers that provide delivery services or is logged into the network of a delivery network company under AS 2823-80 to the list of individuals who are not covered by the Alaska Workers' Compensation Act. Section 2 amends AS 2823-80A to establish that delivery network companies are not an employer of transportation network drivers or delivery network couriers under AS 2310-699, AS 2320-520, or AS 2330-395. It further clarifies that an independent contractor for all purposes is not an employee of the company if the company does not propose specific working hours, does not impose restrictions on the ability of the driver to use the digital network of other companies, does not restrict a driver from engaging in any other occupation, or if the company enters into a written agreement with the driver or courier stating that the driver is an independent contractor for the company. Section 3 amends AS 2823-180 by adding the definition of digital network to include use by delivery network companies to facilitate offers for delivery services. And Section 4 adds definitions to AS 2823-180 to define company, delivery network company, delivery network company courier or courier, delivery services, and offer.
Okay. Are there questions? Senator Wilikowski?
Thank you. If someone is driving one of these cars and gets in an accident, is there there's some coverage, right? Can you explain how that works?
Thank you, Senator Wilikowski, for the question through the chair. I would have to get back to you on that question.
And yeah, I'd be interested because we're exempt them from workers' comp, and they're working and they're making the company money. And then they get into an accident. Somebody gets in the car and has a disease that they get under workers' comp. They would be covered for health care and vocational rehab potentially, and temporary total disability, permanent disability, whatever. So I'd be interested in how comparable the benefits are that they're currently getting. And then just on Section 4, where it says company. Number 7 there means transportation network company or delivery network company. I'm just wanting to make sure, are we inadvertently taking in, for example, FedEx or UPS or the United States Postal Service? Would they inadvertently be swept into that definition?
That is a really good, through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, that's a good question. We can double check with folks at the Department of Labor as well as the Division of Insurance on both of those questions.
Thank you.
Good questions. Further questions? Senator Yunt?
Yeah. Through the chair to the sponsor, a couple of quick ones. Do you guys have a sense of how many customers there are in Alaska, possibly, for that Uber Eats and others similar may serve on a daily or weekly basis?
I'm not sure in totality between all of the apps and contemplating who might use more than one app. I believe Uber Eats has over 16,000 individual Alaskan customers per month. I think DoorDash is very close behind them, something like 14,600 customers. Quite a few Alaskans use these types of delivery services.
Follow up. Thank you. Do you know of any states where these type of app drivers are considered employees? Are there any that they are considered employees? Or
I'm not aware of any political subdivisions in which these types of delivery drivers are considered employees.
And if I could add on that real quick, through the chair to Senator Young, no, none of the 50 states include them as employees.
Okay. One more?
Yeah.
Thank you. If the state of Alaska were to determine someday that these are employees, do you have a indication that has there been any polls done of current contract drivers or, not a contract, but individual drivers, how they feel? Would they continue to serve the market if they were employees? And
thank you for the question through the chair to Senator Yunt. We've gotten feedback from a number of drivers that if they were to be considered employees, it would not fit their expectation of what kind of their job as a delivery driver is or would like to be. They really value the ability to choose runs that they can go on and to choose how much or not at all that they would like to do this type of work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Young. Any further questions? Okay, we have some folks who are here for testimony. I'll just go ahead and open, invited, and public testimony and go to the first person I see. First person we have for invited testimony on Teams joining us is John Finley, public policy with Uber.
Hi there. Can you all hear me? I know I am on virtually.
Yep, we can hear you and see you.
All right. Thank you very much, Chair Kawasaki and Vice Chair Bjorkman, members of the committee. My name is John Finley, speaking on behalf of Uber Eats. Can I first say that I appreciate you creating a virtual option to participate, because I'm based in Northern California. Our offices are in San Francisco. I haven't actually had the chance to visit Alaska, and I hope I can sometime soon, but happy to be joining you all here today. Senate Bill 35, the main reason we are calling in to support is that it updates the current law to affirm the status for delivery workers that already exists for transportation network company drivers. We have so many folks who use both Uber Eats and the Uber Rides platform at the same time, and this would clarify current law to say that they're treated the same under Alaska law, ensuring consistency and protecting the independence of our workforce. I can say that here in California, we have had extensive conversations about the status and flexibility of work, and couriers and drivers say that that is the number one reason they choose to earn on platforms like Uber, is so that they can pursue work that fits their flexible lifestyle. We don't tell them when they have to work. We don't tell them that they can't sign up for DoorDash or Lyft or some other service, and that's what's really appealing about earning on a platform like Uber. But in Alaska, the absence of clear statutory guidance on this creates some legal uncertainty. And for us, that really could impact these app-based delivery services that many Alaskans are depending on, many Alaska restaurants are dependent on. Since we launched in Anchorage in 2020, we've helped to drive local economic growth, empower small businesses, really just make life a little easier for community members by making food and other types of everyday essentials more accessible. I don't know how many of you all have used Uber Eats or an app like that in the past few weeks, but you can really get anything on there. I appreciate the senator mentioning medical prescriptions. That's something that we partner with health insurance agencies to make sure people can get their prescriptions quickly. So more can be done on this than just food, groceries, essentials. People are actually able to use their government food benefits in order to order groceries and get them delivered. So this has opened up a whole new world of participating in the local economy. We also help local businesses reach new customers, grow their portfolio, grow their business without taking on the big overhead costs that delivery would require. And we put out data on this all of the time. Our most recent merchant impact report, 85% of restaurants say Uber Eats provides opportunities for delivery that they wouldn't have been able to support without partnering with Uber. So that gives you an example of how restaurants are able to compete and able to stay alive. Local mom and pop shops, especially in the pandemic, but as the economy changes and as we continue to grow, they're able to stay competitive. And you can order from your favorite local neighborhood shop the same way you'd be able to order from Amazon or order from a major pizza chain. So we really believe that these kinds of platforms help to power local business. And we just ask that you continue to protect and support this independent, flexible work model that's benefited Alaskans. Alaskans are still using it. More than 15,000 Alaska couriers, restaurants, customers are utilizing just Uber Eats on a monthly basis. So we're asking for your support for that economic opportunity and innovation to continue in Alaska. Thank you very much for your time and your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Finley. There was a question earlier about what is this the same model that's done in all the other states, or are there different models where a driver could be considered an employee of Uber itself?
There are no states in the United States where a driver to clarify, we're talking about drivers and delivery workers, right?
There are
certainly no places. There are no places in the United States where either is considered an employee. Everywhere in the USA, these drivers and delivery workers are independent contractors, and that this fight has actually happened in a couple of different ways. There are some states where there are statutes in place that were either voted on by the people. That's what I'm familiar with in California. We had a voter proposition, Prop 22, that cemented independent contractor status, but also provided some additional benefits that did not exist before. That was a voter-driven initiative that passed overwhelmingly in California, but cemented that independent contractor status that had been in legal dispute prior to that. So there's nowhere where they're identified as employees, but there are what we call it, the company Independent Contractor Plus. There are some states that have additional things in statute, but nowhere where either one is identified as an employee.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Finley. There was actually another question regarding one of the – this in particular is asking that this be one of the exempted people from the state's workers' compensation insurance. What happens when a person does get injured on the job?
When a person – in terms of like bodily injury, not physical damage to a vehicle?
Yeah. Not physical damage to the vehicle, but the person themselves, the employee.
Yeah, so I'll actually have to go and verify that with our insurance folks. Apologize for not having that just because I'm not in Alaska. I have to check what we provide in Alaska. But we do provide $1 million in liability coverage when somebody is in an accident. And so if somebody were to – I just have to double check on the occupational hazard insurance. But I can get back to the committee with that answer.
Super. Thank you very much, Mr. Finley. Any further questions? Okay. Hearing and seeing none, thank you very much for being online. We'll move on next to Anchorage. We have Mr. Patrick Fitzgerald. If you'd like to state your name and your affiliation for the record, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. This is Patrick Fitzgerald calling from Anchorage, representing Teamsters Local 959. I'll just get right into my testimony. Senate Bill 35 creates an exemption for delivery network companies such as DoorDash and Amazon Eats to be aligned with other transportation network companies such as Uber and Lyft as being exempt for workers' compensation. This legislation reclassifies the DMCs as private contractors who are responsible for their own health insurance, equipment maintenance, and now what could be workers' compensation. We oppose the classification of these workers as private contractors as they are making money for a company through a technological service with zero liability to the company. Operations like DoorDash, Amazon Eats, and many others have continually shed their responsibilities to their workforce through small rollbacks on their obligations to provide for the private contractors, which earn them billions of dollars on an annual basis. These private contractors are expected to earn approximately $58,000 a year on average, according to Indeed.com, with the cost of fuel, vehicle maintenance, and all their operational budgeting being their responsibility. For these workers to now bear the responsibility of providing for their own workers' compensation themselves in a field that operates vehicles on Alaska road systems, which may be considered high risk at times, is unfair and dangerous. This legislation peels away another layer of responsibility for a global company that makes millions with the labor of their workforce with little to no responsibility for those who are providing them their earnings. Workers' compensation is a bare minimum standard of liability for every company on the Fortune 500 scale should provide to their own workforce. I do appreciate what Senator Bjorkman and his staff are doing with trying to align the delivery network companies with the transportation network companies, but we believe that these companies should provide workers' compensation for their employees. We ask that these classifications are revisited and workers' compensation be provided for the workers earning them their money.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Fitzgerald. Are there any questions? I do have a question. I know that you – I'm pretty sure you guys represent FedEx, but does – there was a question from Senator Wilkowski about whether the description of this delivery network company, or I guess the definition section 4 of the bill relates to courier, whether it might be considered that a FedEx employee might be considered a courier.
So we represent UPS. We do not represent FedEx, but the same principle. We don't believe that this will affect our employees at UPS. As they're employees of the company, they're not considered private contractors.
Okay. Further questions? Okay. Hearing and seeing none, thank you, Mr. Fitzgerald, for your testimony. We'll move on to California, where we have Jessica Lyman with Instacart. Can you hear us?
Hello, Chair Kawasaki and members of the State Affairs Committee. My name is Jessica Lyman, and I am the Government Affairs Manager for the Western U.S. at Instacart. I'm here today to testify in strong support of SB 35 and thank Vice Chair Bjorkman for bringing this measure forward. As others have mentioned, this bill preserves the independence and flexibility that shoppers on the Instacart platform consistently say that they want and need, while also aligning with the flexibility already provided to rideshare drivers here in Alaska. Instacart is the leading grocery technology company in Northern America, and we proudly offer flexible earning opportunities to more than 1,600 Alaskans who we proudly call our shoppers. These individuals who pick, pack, and deliver orders. Our shoppers are caretakers, their parents, their students, and even retirees who are just looking for some alternatives to traditional employment or are seeking some supplemental income. Over 80% of these shoppers say that they choose to shop on Instacart for the flexibility and independence that it provides. Shoppers have the freedom and the flexibility to choose when and where and how long they work with no set schedules or obligations. In terms of local impact, Instacart partners with over 25 retail banners and more than 130 stores statewide, with almost half of those stores accepting EBT SNAP. A 2022 NARA economic consulting study found that these partnerships have contributed to the creation of over 130 brick-and-mortar grocery jobs from cashiers to store managers and approximately $5.1 million in additional revenue for Alaskan grocers. For app-based workers, SB 35 provides the flexibility, the choice, the independence, which are all key motivators for why shoppers choose to work in the first place. Whether they're delivering groceries or prescriptions or other essential goods, these individuals deserve the same clear framework that has been successful for Alaskan rideshare drivers. This legislation is key to provide fairness and clarity for consistency purposes, while also supporting the essential goods that so many Alaskans rely on. Thank you for the opportunity to speak this afternoon, and I strongly urge an aye vote on this measure.
Thank you, Ms. Lyman. I had a question earlier that wasn't able to be answered regarding what happens when a person is injured or claims an injury normally under a workers' comp, say like an overuse injury. What happens to that person? What does Instacart do in that case?
Yes, thank you for that question, Chairman. I am able to share that Instacart provides occupational accident insurance to shoppers at no cost. This insurance provides coverage for shoppers in the unfortunate event that they are injured while on a batch.
Great. Thank you very much for your response, and thank you very much for your testimony today. We'll go ahead now to Anchorage, where we have Carrie Norrie from the Alaska Chamber of Commerce. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Chair Kawasaki and members of the State Affairs Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. My name is Carrie Norrie, and I serve as the Director of External Affairs for the Alaska Chamber of Commerce. And I'm testifying today in support of Senate Bill 35. The Alaska Chamber is the state's largest statewide business advocacy organization. Our mission is to promote a healthy business environment in Alaska. The Chamber has more than 700 members and represents businesses of all sizes and industries from across the state, representing 58,000 Alaskan workers and $4.6 billion in wages. Delivery network companies provide convenient and affordable delivery of goods to Alaskans. They also provide economic opportunity to people who can use this avenue to garner additional income. It is estimated that one delivery network company operating in Alaska has 14,500 Alaskans working on their platform, and 89% of those Alaskans work less than 10 hours per week. This highlights how delivery network companies provide opportunities for Alaskans to make a supplemental income on their terms. CINEPL 35 would establish standards that reflect the reality of app-based work, the same standards that the state already uses for rideshare drivers, and provide delivery network companies and delivery drivers in Alaska with greater regulatory certainty. Furthermore, this would ensure Alaska stays in line with the developments in other states where marketplace platform workers across all platforms are treated uniformly. Businesses need consistency in the laws and regulations governing them to thrive in the economy. Senate Bill 35 is a free enterprise and good for business bill, and we encourage swift passage. And we thank you for considering the Alaska Chamber's comments.
Great. Thank you very much, Kari. Are there any questions? Actually, I do have a question, I don't know if you're able to answer this or not. This would extend the list of persons who are not covered under the workers' compensation law. The workers' compensation pool is a large pool. It's most of the folks in the state minus these 13 different jobs, job classes. So this is now the third. This would be the 13th job class, and I thought that the chamber would normally want everybody to be included under workers' comp as a sort of fairness issue. I don't know. I don't actually remember what the debate was when Uber and Lyft were here, though. But do you have any comments on that?
I would have to get back to you on that, Senator Kawasaki. That's not something that I am super familiar with.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. Just wanted to note for the record that Senator Gray Jackson is with us. And we'll go ahead and move on to Anna Powell in Seattle with Government Relations at DoorDash. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, thanks so much. Can you hear me okay?
We sure can.
Great, thank you. Hi, Senator Kawasaki and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Anna Powell. I'm the Senior Manager of Government Relations for DoorDash in the Northwest. DoorDash is a technology company that empowers the local economy by connecting consumers with their favorite local businesses. In this state alone, we partner with more than 700 merchants and more than 14,000 couriers, or as we call them, Dashers, who choose to earn supplemental income by delivering food, groceries, and other goods throughout their community. DoorDash stands with the Dasher community, who overwhelmingly prefer to remain independent contractors, and offers the following comments in support of Senate Bill 35. Alaska Dashers value the independence and flexibility that dashing provides. The Dasher never needs to commit to a schedule to be online, is free to decline any work or offer for work that they are sent, and can leave the platform for weeks or months at a time and come back whenever a new need arises. Time and time again, Dashers tell us that the top motivation for using platforms like DoorDash is the ability to create their own schedule and work as much or as little as they want. Why? Well, because Dashers do relatively little work on the platform. In 2023, on average, Dashers in Alaska spent only 5 hours per week on delivery, and almost 90% delivered less than 10 hours per week. The vast majority have other primary sources of income or responsibilities and use the platform only for supplemental work. In the survey just last year, 82% of Dasher respondents say they have a full-time or part-time job, are self-employed, are students, or stay-at-home caregivers, or retired. The flexibility and independence that Dashers highly value is incompatible with traditional employment. That's why in a survey last year, more than 90% of Dasher respondents said they preferred to remain independent contractors. Senate Bill 35 would protect that independence of Dashers and other app-based delivery workers. Many existing worker classification standards were not created with app-based work and workers in mind. Senate Bill 35 would establish a classification test for app-based workers that recognizes the unique nature of this work. This standard is already used in Alaska for rideshare drivers and is similar to standards for app-based workers that have been adopted in numerous states, including Arizona, California, Florida, Indiana, Iowa, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Utah. DoorDash strongly supports Senate Bill 35 that would protect the flexibility this type of work provides to the thousands of Dashers who choose it. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much for being online, Ms. Powell. Are there any questions? Okay, hearing and seeing none, thank you very much for your public testimony. Is there anybody else in the room who would like to testify on Senate Bill 35? Anybody else in the room or online? Okay, hearing and seeing none, we'll go ahead and close public testimony. We can go ahead and also receive public testimony through the Senate State Affairs Committee through email. That is senatestateaffairs@aklag.gov, senatestateaffairs@aklag.gov. Let's see. Do you have any closing statements you'd like to make, Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Just to recap, Senate Bill 35 seeks to put delivery network companies on par with transportation network companies and making sure that folks who want to engage in this type of delivery work can do so at their leisure without the extra constraints of being categorized as employees. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thank you, Senator Bjorkman. With that, we will go ahead and set Senate Bill 35 aside. We will next take up Senate Bill 34. Senate Bill 34, sponsored by Senator Kathy Geisel. It is to repeal the 90-day session limit. Senator Geisel and her staff, Paige Brown, are here to present the bill. And I know that if you have to leave after your introduction, that's fine.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Geisel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Kathy Geisel. I have the honor of representing Senate District E. That's in part of Anchorage. Mr. Chairman, I'm delighted to be here. In the 13 years I've been in the legislature, I don't think I've ever had a bill before State Affairs before. So this is great. Senate Bill 34, as you cited its short title, does repeal the 90-day regular session. This was a citizens' initiative, Mr. Chairman, as you may recall, that passed in 2006. So that was 19 years ago. It was intended to streamline the legislative process and reduce the extended sessions that were being experienced at the time. The legislature has only met that 90-day limit for a session three times since it passed. Two of these instances were in the early days of its adoption. The third occurred during the COVID-19 pandemic. That was in 2020 and obviously was an exceptional circumstance. The legislature has frequently extended the sessions even beyond the 121-day constitutional limit. More extended and special sessions actually simply raise the cost rather than reducing them. Managing natural resources, budgeting, major policies, all of these demand significant discussion and debate, Mr. Chairman. I know that as you sit here, you can think of many of those issues that are even before us today. As the budget challenges are growing with inflation and reduced revenue, more discussion is needed for balancing very difficult budgets. In 2020, the legislature met for 69 days due to pandemic restrictions. However, in 2021, the next year, the legislature was in session for 217 days to compensate for the lost time experienced the previous year. Artificial time restraints are not limiting, are not eliminating the legislative need for debate and discussion. The public expects the sessions to follow the law, conclude in 90 days. Unfortunately, this is unrealistic due to the huge policy issues that we face today. This leads to public frustration. There's a law in place, 90-day sessions. We are not achieving it. So the 90-day session requirement is failing to ensure efficiency or cost savings as it was originally intended, certainly with good intention by the public. It forces unnecessary special sessions that increase the legislative workload and cost. And, Mr. Chairman, it's simply arbitrary and unrealistic time limitation. So with that, Mr. Chairman, thank you for hearing Senate Bill 34. It is an opportunity to remove a statute that, frankly, has not been working. Mr. Chairman, I do have another meeting. I'm going to turn the management of the bill over to my very capable staff, Paige Brown. And thank you again for so much for hearing the bill.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Are there any questions before she leaves? Okay. Thank you very much for the presentation of the bill. And we will now turn over to Ms. Brown. If you'd like to introduce yourself, put yourself on the record, and if you have any comments to make or if you want to read the sectional into the record.
Thank you. For the record, Paige Brown, staff to Senator Giesel. Section 1 repeals the statute requiring the legislature to adjourn from a regular session within 90 consecutive calendar days, including the day the legislature first convenes in that regular session. That concludes the sectional.
Pretty simple. Okay. Let's see. Are there any questions for Ms. Brown? Okay. Hearing and seeing none. We do have public testimony. It was recorded for public testimony for both this bill and the following bill. So we're going to go ahead and open up public testimony. We do have one person who's online, I believe. That's Mr. Ed Martin. If you would like to state your name and your affiliation, you've got 2 minutes.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Of the Senate Affairs Committee. This is Ed Martin from Kenai, Alaska. I think all you people well know me. I'm dead against this bill. First off, the inherent flaw, which she spells out in her sponsored statement, is the biggest flaw of all is Article 1, Section 1, or Section 2, the inherent power of the people. This was voted in by the people. And you know something? There was one other thing that was close to that election of the people was the advisory on the permanent fund, not to touch the permanent fund dividend. Now, I can tell you several other things that should be a priority for the legislature if we're going to do anything about how you respond to the needs of the state. Yes, the budget is the most important part of your job, but I can tell you there are several other ones. Appointments to boards and commissions should be number one on your list, and any new judges to our judiciary. Because otherwise we have government by cabal or a vacancy that does not support and protect us under our Constitution. Bills like, naming the state dinosaur. What else? Women's Day. I can go on and on with you folks that aren't what we need to do to pass the budget. You did it during COVID. Oh, that's amazing. And you did it less than 90 days because why? You actually went to doing your job, passing a budget. But I can tell you all kinds of reasons, give you testimony all the way back to the marijuana, passing of the marijuana bill, and then the commission that was established. Okay? Some of those people were not approved by the legislature, and that's what I call government cabal when they roll out regulations, criminal and penalties, and civil penalties, and become law before they're approved by the legislature. Now, if I could continue just a little bit to sum this up, you know, really, you guys, please, you know, look at the Constitution before you go about making new bills, and then make sure every cost of those bills are in those bills you passed. Okay? Thank you very much for my testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Martin. We will see if there's any other testimony here in the room or online. Seeing and hearing none, we'll go ahead and close testimony. We will keep public testimony open on Senate Bill 34 in the 90-day session. If you do have any written testimony, you're welcome to send that to us at senatestateaffairs@akleg.gov. senatestateaffairs@akleg.gov. Ms. Brown, do you have any last questions or comments you'd like to make?
Sorry. We don't have any further comments at this point. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any comments? Okay. Seeing and hearing none from the committee, Senate Bill 34, we will go ahead and set aside for a future hearing. Next to bring up Senate Bill 37. Senate Bill 37 is Strategic Plans for State Agencies. It is sponsored by Senator James Kaufman from Anchorage. He and his staff, Emma Torkelson, will be here to present the bill.
Thank you to the chair and committee. Thanks for hearing this bill. For the record, Senator James Kaufman, Senate District F, Anchorage. And I know these late afternoon committees can get tough, so I'm going to spice it up here and talk about strategic operating plans. For so, can't get much better than this. But I guess the vision of this bill, if you'll just picture a better management framework for state agencies and through a better plan, better execution of the tasks that state agencies take on. And so some of you are familiar with this because it was here in prior legislatures, and it's not really changed from that time. In essence, the problem statement is that we consistently come near or at the bottom in results of many metrics of measuring performance of our state agencies. And I believe that by introducing more of an enterprise-style management plan, in this case, four-year strategic operating plans that are updated every 2 years with the cadence of the legislature, and then our annual funding discussions and the other conversations we have with our agencies are done within the framework of this execution plan. The execution plan, the four-year management plan, is designed to get us to a better operating state. So it actually gives us a framework to look at where we want to be and not just get into this thing that we're pretty much locked in now. We have annual funding plans and conversations around problems, but we don't really have a framework for continuous improvement and for management to a better operating state. So, again, the structure of it's pretty simple. We have the governor sets his priorities, key goals, and objectives. The agencies respond with their four-year strategic operating plans, and then every 2 years they're updated, and then the budgeting cycle is done around the framework of that management plan. And it's been a long day, and I can go on a bit more, but depending on what the committee would like, I can continue with more details about it, or we can shift into the sectional if you want to get straight into that. Pretty much whatever y'all are comfortable with at this point.
Let's see from committee. Any questions for Senator Kaufman? Oh, I'll just start off with a really quick question. It seems like every decade or so we have missions and measures and somebody brings up something similar to this. How do you decide on what are the best metrics to use to figure out if you're doing a good job for our particular thing?
Well, thank you to the chair. So that's the best way to do that is have the people that are doing the work that are really close to the problem and understand what the best metrics are. It can be really hard to do that if you don't really understand, you know, in order to fly a plane, you are going to measure airspeed, altitude, a few other key things because you know how to fly a plane. And the same thing is true if you're someone that is enmeshed in the system. You look at you learn what you need to measure. And I guess that brings up an important thing with this is that if we try to set those performance standards from the legislature, they're locked into statute. The better way to do it is to create a framework where we legislate what we want in a department, but then they have to figure out how to do it, have to deliver it, and through this system, they'll surface it. So they'll actually surface what the plan is and what their metrics are, and that's what we'll be discussing along with the annual funding plan.
Great. Thank you, Senator. Ms. Torkelson, if you'd like to read the sectional in the record, that'd be great.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Kawasaki and members of the Senate State Affairs Committee. For the record, Emma Torkelson, staff to Senator Kaufman. This is kind of a long and technical bill, as you have seen, and the sectional also is long. So I have a paraphrased version if you're all right with me proceeding that way.
That would be fine. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So Section 1 is conforming language, or conforming change to reference the new planning structure created later in the bill. Section 2 are several language changes to align earlier sections of the current Executive Budget Act to the new sections that will be created later in the bill. Section 3 and 4 make agencies responsible for setting their mission statements and performance measures rather than the legislature, and adds a reference to the plan structure created later. It further directs the legislature to use the mission statements and performance measures to determine if agencies' goals are being achieved. Providing, as Senator Kaufman talked about, providing agencies with the ability to write and communicate these missions and measures, as you talked about, will increase the likelihood, or we believe that they'll increase the likelihood that agencies will make progress toward those goals. Section 5 updates language to reference strategic plans created later in the bill. Section 6 makes changes to clarify that the legislature is to refer to those strategic plans, mission statements, and financial plans in our budgeting process each year. Section 7 makes changes to clarify that each state entity shall allocate resources to implement multi-year plans, express program results in measurable terms, measure progress toward multi-year plans and other results, promote activities consistent with multi-year plans and that reduce future costs, plan for both short and long-term, plan for both the long-term and the short-term, require accountability at all levels for meeting these multi-year plans, and then it adds a reference to strategic planning in this section. Finally, it requires quarterly reporting to OMB on the progress toward the performance plan. So agencies need to report to OMB quarterly on how they're proceeding through the yearly plan. Section 8 defines state entities as all executive branch departments and the University of Alaska. Section 9 directs the governor to review, revise if he or she would like to, and finally approve the mission statements, four-year strategic plans, performance, and financial, and then the annual performance and financial plans. It further directs the governor to use them to execute the law and achieve the desired goals. Section 10 is a conforming change to reference the new planning structure. Section 11 adds the new plans created later in the bill to the list of things OMB is responsible for and further clarifies OMB's role in the planning hierarchy. Section 12 is kind of the meat of the bill that Senator Kaufman alluded to in his opening. It repeals and reenacts AS 3707-050 to require that the executive branch departments and the University of Alaska develop four-year strategic plans that are consistent with the agency's authority and the governor's statewide priorities. These plans must be updated and submitted to OMB at the beginning of each gubernatorial term and then updated at least once every 2 years. It outlines what needs to be in the plans, OMB's role in creating the plans, what they should do if the plans are not submitted by the departments on their own, and then clarifies that all the plans are public information and should be available to members of the public easily. Section 13 creates a new section for boards and commissions. We did not feel that each board and commission should be held to creating a four-year strategic operating plan. So this outlines what information should be reported by boards and commissions annually and then directly exempts them from those larger plan structures. Section 14 amends the current section to require that the governor identify 3 to 5 statewide priorities to guide each agency's four-year strategic plans and their resulting annual plans. Section 15 requires the governor to present the strategic plans and mission statements during his regular address to the legislature. So he just adds his presentation into what he would currently talk about. Section 16 adds a reference to the new plans created in Section 12 and 13 to the list that the legislature reviews. So those Section 12 and 13 created the requirement for all executive branch departments in the University of Alaska to create plans and then boards and commissions, smaller plans. Section 17 similarly adds a reference to the new plans created in Section 12 and 13 and removes old language that referred to the old planning structure. Section 18 clarifies that salary increases must be done in accordance with the plans. Section 19 requires each agency to develop, with employee participation, an annual performance and financial plan consistent with those larger four-year strategic plans and submit them to the legislature with the budget by December 15th. It further outlines, similarly as above, further outlines what should be included in these performance and financial plans, what role OMB plays in their creation, what happens if the agencies do not submit those plans, and then clarifies that they're public information. Section 20 defines the terms goal, objective, performance measure, and strategic plan. Section 21 is a conforming change to include a reference to the new boards and commissions planning requirements. Section 22 is similarly a conforming change to remove a reference to the old method of planning. And then the final section sets a July 1st, 2025 effective date. And that concludes the sectional analysis. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Torkelson. Are there questions for Senator Yount?
No question. It's so much as a comment, but this is a fantastic bill, and I just wanted to thank the sponsor. Coming from the private sector, this is stuff that we do every day and every year. We have to stay successful, and so the state of Alaska is a big business at that, and I just appreciate the approach. I don't think it's anything that the agencies would be upset by or that would distract them from doing what they want to do. If anything, I think it would help them. You know, and so, yeah, I appreciate the approach. Thanks.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, I just wanted to kind of address that. Yes, we've worked with past and present OMB directors, and we've talked about how much work is done already to do what we do and how this is a refinement, a realignment of it. If you ever get a minute, go up in the House Finance Chamber and take a look at all those black books that are up there that nobody looks at. That's what we're doing now. so it's not very beneficial work. And this again, people have tried to do things in government. This is modeled after elements that we found where the federal government has actually done some good work. There's improvements that they've done. And other states, so we benchmarked other states. We've tried to work it all to make it fit within the framework of Alaska and what we believe Alaska needs. So the vision would be that as we're doing what we do here in the legislature, when we're working with these departments and we're working on the budget, that we're all doing it with this strategic vision of improving the state of Alaska through each consecutive year of what we're doing. We're not living within just a snapshot of a one-year cycle. We're starting to have that higher vision, and hopefully we're all aligned or at least informed of it. Even if we don't agree with where it's going, at least it's surfaced and it's present because there's a framework for it. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Senator, for bringing this forward again. I kind of concur. I like this stuff, so it's okay to have this at this late an hour in the afternoon. I did want to say, how do we ensure that the governor and OMB comply with the reporting and some of the requests that are defined in the bill?
Thank you to the chair. Well, we have the power of the purse, and remember the teeth of this thing is that every year when we're having these budgetary discussions, that they're around the framework of where are you at in this plan that you put forth in funding it. And so I believe that as long as the legislature understands where we're at, and again, it'll help because these plans will be public. So if it says here you're going to be operating at this, you know, high level of performance at this point, and then we're starting to have the discussions of how to get there, it'll become painfully obvious that we're not following a good plan. And I think that will be less defensible than it is right now because there's really not the framework for a multi-year plan of the type that this bill envisions.
Thank you, Senator Kaufman. Ms. Torkelson, I'm going to open up public testimony because we did commit to it. We do have one person who's online who'd like to testify. That's Mr. Ed Martin in Kenai. If you could state your name and your affiliation for the record, and you've got 2 minutes to testify on Senate Bill 37.
Can you hear me, Chair?
We sure can.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki and the other members of this committee. I'm in full support. You're probably a little surprised about that. But I listened to the sectional analysis, and it seemed to me that you could probably get by with the first 12. The rest of it seems to be a procedure for which it should be spelled out in the first 12. The other problem that bothers me is this. I wasn't able to call the senator to talk to him about his bill. There's a lot of thought put in it, and I thank him very much for his efforts here. I hope this passes the legislature. But the fiscal note, and I called the director's office of OMB, and they called me back. That was really amazing, a quick time to respond. I asked about that fiscal note, and it's zero. Well, you know, what about all these departments that this mandate's going to go to? We're already short-staffed. They may even recommend some kind of program that makes it easier for them to accomplish this task. There's 12 mission statements here, as I see it, in you know, implementing this. I would like to see an honest review by all departments as to the true cost of what this is going to take. This is a big undertaking, and I believe the senator has a lot of understanding of what that takes. I've worked for corporations as big as the fourth largest defense contractor, and I've been put in those kind of positions. And believe me, it takes time. You can't bypass that at all. It takes personnel, and sometimes it takes a program to get it done and done efficiently. So that's the only downside I see on this. I just want to see an honest fiscal note.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Martin, for the comments on the fiscal note. We have come to the end of the meeting. Let's see if there's any other folks who'd like to testify on Senate Bill 37, either in the room or online. Hearing and seeing none, we will bring Senate Bill 37 back to the committee. Do you have any last comments you'd like to make, Senator Kaufman?
Thank you. Yes, to the chair and the committee. And with respect to the testimony we just heard, I have worked this again with multiple OMB directors, and there is a great deal of work that's done with what we currently do, and that's why in subsequent legislatures we've not received a fiscal note, because once it's understood of what we're really talking about, it's understood how it's a realignment of process and with a more beneficial result. Again, the testifier may not have been able to go up in the House Finance Committee room and look at those big books and may not have seen all the work that's already done. So we've repeatedly gotten assured that this can be built into what the administration's already doing, the executive branch. And perhaps with some, you know, rollout work, it won't be as onerous as people think.
Great. Thank you very much, Senator Kaufman, Ms. Torkelson, for bringing this bill before us. We're going to go ahead and set Senate Bill 37 aside for a future hearing, and that will conclude the meeting of the Senate State Affairs Committee today. Our next meeting is scheduled Thursday, March 20th at 3:30 p.m. We will have on the docket Senate Bill 64 relating to elections. We will hopefully have a new committee substitute with some of the amendments rolled into them based on committee discussion. We will have Senate Bill 120, the Climate Change Commission, which was originally scheduled the prior week. That is sponsored by Senator L.V. Gray Jackson. Senate Bill 107, the Alaska Sunset Commission, sponsored by Senator Shelley Hughes. Senate Bill 25, Judicial Retention Election Information, sponsored by Senator Rob Myers. And Senate Joint Resolution 13, Appointment of State Judges, that is sponsored by Rules by Request of the Governor. If there is no other business facing the committee at this point, this committee is adjourned. Let the record reflect that it is 4:52 p.m.